Now to Kenya's neighbor, Sudan. In 2004, former U.S. Marine Captain Brian Steidel served as an unarmed military observer with the African Union in Darfur. He spent a year there and documented his experiences in the new film and book, The Devil Came on Horseback. Steidel had incredible access to parts of Darfur, which is both dangerous and remote. He used his camera to capture what few outsiders have seen before. One note, some of what he describes is graphic and not meant for young listeners.
You know, I knew it was going to be a monitoring mission. Didn't know how the African Union was going to act, how an 8-man team was going to operate, because we were operating on 4-man teams before that. I think that it is a different role, for sure. But we felt, you know, all of us on the ground, the monitors, we all felt that by watching, observing, taking pictures, writing reports, that those reports were going up and something was happening. So therefore, that was our action. We would prefer to, you know, have a huge armed groups being able to stop these atrocities, but this was the only thing that could happen. And so we felt that we were at least doing something rather than doing nothing at all.
When was the first time that you saw a body or a village that was destroyed? Describe that moment.
Traveling to Darfur, we saw, you know, burning villages, you know, in the airplane before we even landed. And the next day or the third day, where we headed out to an IDP camp, internally displaced persons camp, that had been attacked by the Janjaweed on their market day, and they killed a number of people that were there.
There's a lot of graphic footage in the film. And when you would see the bodies of children who were beaten to death or people who were burnt alive, what did you feel? Were you prepared for that kind of a reality?
No, I mean, nobody, I mean, those things don't supposed to happen, and you don't supposed to see them. And yeah, I mean, it was totally horrific. And the way that after these people have been killed, that the way they're treated, you know, I wrote in my book about one incident where there was a gentleman who had been burned alive in his hut. Right next to him, there's another man who had been shot 2-3 days earlier, you know, completely distended. And 10 feet away from him were 10 Sudanese soldiers that were cooking breakfast over a fire. The smell was tremendous, let alone that they're eating breakfast, you know, 10 feet away from, you know, a couple of burned dead guys. And to me, that is amazing, the way that some of these people, you know, they're like, well, it's not my guy, you know, he's not on my side, so I'm just going to leave him here and let him rot in the sun. And they do that. I think one of the ways you deal with it is you take a step back and say, okay, I'm documenting this. And for me, it was through my camera. You know, I put the camera between me and those people, and I took the pictures to document it for later.
Why did you decide to take so many photos? Was it really a part of what you thought would save people? Like, this information is going to go up. These pictures are going to save people. Why did you take so many and such vivid pictures?
Part of it was we were documenting it for the actual reports. In order to say these people were killed, you need a picture of them. You write it in a report. We wanted to get, you know, concrete evidence. This is what happened. Here are the shrapnel from the aircraft. Here are the impacts from the bombs. Things like that they could not be disputed by the government if they were in a report, a physical, here's a picture of it. I never intended to take these pictures and then release them to the press and use them in a documentary, in a book. I wanted to take them so that they could be documented for history's sake, so that I could share them with my friends and families to let them know what I had gone through. And then it kind of just evolved into, hey, if we want to do something good, if we want to share this information with people, these photographs are one of the best tools that are out there.
You took all these photos. You were in danger yourself doing the work that you did. And then you made a decision to stop doing what you were doing. Why?
Well, I felt that when I started finding out information that the reports that we were writing were not getting where they should go. They were getting up through the African Union, but somehow they were being suppressed. They were being lost. They weren't doing what they intended to do. I realized that, you know, my purpose on the ground was, you know, as I said before, I felt like I was doing something. And when I found out that these reports weren't going anywhere and nothing was happening with them, I felt as if I was just some other person standing by. And I didn't want to have a part of the mission where I simply stood by and counted dead bodies and gave the people of Darfur a false hope that we were actually going to stop something, that these reports were actually going somewhere, that we were actually doing something, when I felt that we weren't. And so I decided that it was time for me to leave the mission and go home.
You come from a military family. You've served in the military. you were dealing with the whole chain of command through the State Department to the commander-in-chief, the president. Although Colin Powell called this a genocide, the U.S. has not acted aggressively. Do you fault this country's leadership for what's going on?
I don't necessarily fault the leadership, because the way I look at it is that the leadership of this country serves us, and that if we want them to do something, then we have to stand up and tell them. And it has to be an overwhelming majority of people making noise, saying this has got to stop, this genocide has to stop. I was speaking on a panel with a gentleman named Arthur Mutambara, who is a Zimbabwean opposition leader. And he said that there's failures on three different levels. First of all, the failure is of the Sudanese government in failing to protect their own people. And then he said the second level is of the African continent, and even further, of the African populations, the African diaspora around the world. And within that, he said, it's the African-American community within this country as a failure to protect the people that are like themselves back in their own country, where they come from. And then on the third level, he said that it's a failure of humans, of mankind, of standing by and allowing something like this to happen. And so I don't fault one person or another. I basically look around and say, you know, and look at somebody and say, well, what have you done?
Let me take two cuts on what you just said. One is, we've had Arthur Mutambara on, and this whole idea that African Americans should look out for people on the continent. Some people would say, well, not really. We may have some common ancestry, but why should we be responsible for people who live thousands of miles away? And in addition, kind of different perspective, some people say, well, yeah, Black Americans don't act except if there's a white oppressor. And in this case, the people who were dealing out the genocide are not white. How do you respond to those ideas?
You know, that was his analogy of the African populations around the world. I think, you know, what you said about how the African-American population within the United States sometimes doesn't move unless it is a white oppressor, I think that they should move no matter what, whether it's a white oppressor, whether it's a Black oppressor, whether it's an Arab oppressor, no matter what. That simple notion of oppression is wrong in any right, and that we should all look at it as, if we want to be equal, then we have to choose our fights equally also.
You've spoken at a lot of rallies, and you say, okay, people call their congresspeople. Do you really believe that? In a country where, for example, in the past few years, there's a lot of evidence that our leaders are not necessarily swayed by public opinion, unless, of course, you vote them out. Do you really believe that the individual, and I don't mean an individual like you who has a very firsthand experience, but an individual maybe with a Save Darfur sign on their front lawn, as I've seen in many places, that they're going to make a difference?
I do, because if you put a Save Darfur banner on your front lawn, then somebody's going to drive by and go, Save Darfur, what's that? And then they'll Google it up and they'll start learning. You've influenced one person, and that's great. That was a step in the right direction. And hopefully they will then go tell their friends and their family, and it will spread that way. Specifically speaking about congressmen and senators and calling them, it does make a difference, especially if you write a handwritten letter, because that normally comes straight to their desk. It takes a little bit longer because of the screening process now. But it does come to them, and they will read it.
Why should I care? Why should I care about Darfur? There's plenty of problems in the U.S. There's plenty of problems with international relations that relate to the U.S. directly. Why is this important? Why should I care?
Well, I think that you're right. There are a lot of issues, you know, that we need to deal with in the United States, from homelessness to health care to welfare to Social Security. I mean, there's a lot of issues that go on in the United States. There's also a lot of issues around the world. Why Darfur? Why Sudan? Because it's the only ongoing genocide that's happening right now. It's the first genocide of the 21st century. And hopefully we can set up a platform. Hopefully we can end this one so that there won't be any more. There have been genocides as long as the world can remember. And hopefully this time we will say we stopped a genocide while it was happening. We haven't done that before. You know, I mean, I had a discussion with a gentleman the other day about homelessness in the United States, and how he thought that homelessness in the United States was more important than a genocide in Darfur. And I tried to tell him, you know, I said, look, I'm not saying one's more important than the other. You know, I've been there, so I'm talking about this. I haven't been homeless in the United States. Is it an issue that needs to be addressed? Absolutely. But when I get a man that's 300 pounds on the street begging for my change, I don't really have sympathy for him. You know, a guy who's got a huge belly, who looks quite healthy, he's got a nice tan on, a backpack on, and shoes and clothes. He doesn't have people hunting him down and trying to kill him on a daily basis. He's eaten probably yesterday or the day before, and it hasn't starved for, you know, months. His family hasn't been murdered and massacred, and his wife raped. So for me, I say, well, I'm going to put my efforts towards this, because I look at him and I look at somebody in Darfur as the same. I don't look at him as, well, I need to care for him because he's in the United States, and I don't need to care for them because they're outside. They are two humans on this earth. As soon as people start looking at people that way, this guy's human, this guy's human, I think things will start changing.
Well, Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Former U.S. Marine Captain Brian Steidel. You can see Darfur through his eyes in the new documentary, The Devil Came on Horseback. And you can hear him read an excerpt from his memoir of the same name at our website, nprnewsandnotes.org.